dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We often forget that 90 miles off our own coast is one of the frontiers of that war for the free world. It is, of course, the island of Cuba, which has been suffering for decades under the oppressive rule of one Castro after another and continues to be enslaved in sort of a frozen in amber kind of totalitarian communist system. A man who has been fighting for most of those decades to free Cuba from this horror is our first guest. He is Frank Calzone. He is the executive director of the Center for a Free Cuba, based here in Washington, D.C. Frank is a man that we talk with from time to time, and I wanted particularly to catch up with him in the aftermath of the recently announced renewed and intensified, in some cases, I believe, sanctions on Cuba, announced by John Bolton at an event down in Florida last week. Frank Calzone, it is so good to have you with us again. Welcome back, and tell us about the latest turn of events.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. The announcement by the National Security Advisor, Ambassador Bolton, in Florida is very important. There's a little bit of confusion about some of these things. What the administration has done is to allow the law, which was passed under Helms-Burton, to be implemented. For many years, Title III of a law was suspended every 6 months. What the law says is that if an American had property stolen, confiscated by the Cuban government, no matter when, they could, and there is a foreign company that is profiting from that property in Cuba, and that company has business or assets in the United States, then the American owner of that property could go to court and try to find some legal remedy for it. The law, Title III, does not prohibit doing business in Cuba. What it says is that if a foreigner does business in Cuba and profits from stealing American property, the American owner could take him to court.
Got it. So the effect of this intensification, I guess it's fair to say, of the sanctions on Cuba would be to essentially tighten further the screws on a government that's already in pretty desperate straits. Is there any sign that you can detect, Frank Calzone, that this is having the effect that's been long sought, namely to undermine the regime and help the people of Cuba liberate themselves from it?
Well, it might be too early to tell in the big picture, but the fact is that when you are an investor and you're considering investing money somewhere, the issue of having to go to court to defend yourself is a serious problem. So right from the very immediately after Bolton made the announcement, foreigners thinking about investing in Cuba had to take notice. The Cuban government, of course, tries to present things in a different light. The Cuban government is telling the Cuban people that this is an effort to take away their homes. It has nothing to do with their homes. It has to do with commercial property stolen by the Cuban government. And most interesting, the folks, the Europeans and others who criticize the administration, they do not say that they are not profiting from stolen property. They simply argue that the United States should do nothing to protect Americans whose property was stolen in Cuba.
Very important distinction there, and helpful to understanding the object of the Trump effort against this member of what John Bolton has called the Troika of Tyranny, along with Venezuela and Nicaragua. Let me ask you, if Cuba has been directly involved in propping up the Maduro regime in Venezuela, Frank Calzone, clearly the basis for that has in part at least been that Hugo Chavez initially and then Nicolas Maduro subsequently were sending large quantities of heavily subsidized, in some cases, I guess, actually free oil, the property of the Venezuelan people, off to help prop up the regime of the Castro team. What is the state of play at the moment, as you see it, with respect to that deal, that ability on the part of Maduro to subsidize the Cubans and the Cubans' ability to prop up the Maduro government?
Well, the economic crisis in Venezuela has impacted already on the ability of Caracas to send assistance, oil, and other resources to Havana while the Venezuelans are starving. On top of that, the U.S. government has put sanctions in place so that ships that take oil from Venezuela to Cuba are not allowed then to come to the United States. That's going to have a great impact in the future. Beyond that, the investors around the world should welcome any effort by any government to allow them to go to court to claim some judicial help in fighting for the property. The investors, American investors, cannot go to the Cuban courts because there's no rule of law in Cuba. If this was happening in a normal country, in France, in Spain, then the American investor would go to those courts and fight it there. But in Cuba, you cannot do that. There's also a precedent. This is not the first time that someone could go to an American court to find a judicial remedy for something that happened outside the United States. We all know that if you're a torturer, you're someone who did awful things to people elsewhere, the victims could go to the U.S. court and go after you if you live in the United States.
Yeah. This is, of course, the crux of the matter, is that the various techniques that we have at our disposal to create further pressure, create further undermining of this oppressive government, and what it's doing not only to its own people, but in our hemisphere, is, it seems to me, what we must be about. And Frank Calzone, you have been in the vanguard of helping successive U.S. administrations and the rest of us understand what we can do to help bring about a free Cuba.
The Cuban-Venezuelan crisis also has a Russian impact. The Russian troops in Venezuela today, if Putin is willing to deploy forces in Venezuela, what does that say about his intentions nearer Russia in Europe?
Well, that's absolutely true. Frank Calzone, we have to leave it at that. We appreciate so much your visits. Come back to us again very soon with updates, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Diana West, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's our visit time with Diana West, an extraordinary analyst, author, essayist, and clear thinker about the challenges of our time. She is the author, of course, of Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers of the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. We can find her collective writings and works at dianawest.net as well, and, of course, here each week with her visits with us. Diana, thank you so much for joining us. It's always good to have you. Welcome back.
Yes, wonderful to be back.
You've written just recently, in the aftermath of the release of the Mueller report at Epoch Times, a very provocatively titled piece, "Is the Mueller Report the Son of the Steele Dossier?" Walk us through that, if you would.
Yes. Well, the answer is yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. But here's where it is quite relevant and important. We looked at this document, 450 pages, roughly, coming out of the special counsel's office, and I was quite intrigued by Representative Devin Nunes' comment about it, which was that there was one relevant item in this massive document, and that had to do with the very veiled revelation that Steele dossier information was the predicate of the special counsel investigation, the predicate of the Mueller report. In fact, in other words, a hoax was the predicate of the investigation. So this sort of is the genesis of asking this question in terms of noting its provenance. And we have to note also that the Mueller report does not go into that, does not investigate the dossier. We have to also note that when we have Attorney General Barr congratulating Robert Mueller on the investigation, you know, he's playing into this charade. And I think that it's something that, you know, obviously the piece has a lot more detail, and I hope people read it, because this is a very important thing not to lose sight of as we see the implications and you know, emanations from the Mueller report going forward.
Yeah. And of course, the Steele dossier, for those who have been living under a rock for the past 2 years, is a document that was produced originally, we're told, by some Republican donor for opposition research against then candidate for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump, subsequently picked up and run with by Hillary Clinton's campaign through cutouts. And it is, in fact, a fraud. And therefore, as a result, as you say, Dinah West, and as Devin Nunes points out, it was really a hoax. But it was a hoax with a purpose. And just remind us of what you have ferreted out through your deep dive on the ideological drivers behind the anti-Trump conspiracy, as you call it, in the Red Threat, that makes this hoax so devastatingly insidious.
Yes, well, the Steele dossier, which actually Steele was not involved in the Republican Fusion GPS collaboration going after candidate Trump. It was after the Republicans dropped out of the project as Donald Trump became, you know, clearly the nominee or the unofficial nominee, picked up with Hillary Clinton and the DNC. And that's when you see the former intelligence officer from Britain coming into the project. And you see the whole Russian story evolve. It became the leading weapon of disinformation used to spy on the Trump campaign and presidency, to subvert the secret FISA court process, to bring domestic surveillance into our whole political process in an effort to overturn an election. I mean, it's against the weapon is targeting Donald Trump, and yet the larger target is the American people who voted for him. The 63 million Americans who voted for him are actually the targets of the Steele dossier.
Well, one might even argue that our entire Democratic Republic was the target ultimately, because they were determined to defy the will of that 63 million people. Dan, let me switch gears, because among the many things that you have followed over the years and done so brilliantly, I might say, has been, of course, the phenomenon of, well, I call it Sharia supremacism, and how it is manifesting itself in various ways. And I thought we might start with getting your take on the attacks on Easter in Sri Lanka, which we're now told were not just brought to the Christian population there by two local Islamist extremist groups, but apparently by an outside force, perhaps Islamic State is now taking credit for it, perhaps others. But put it into context for us, would you? What is going on here? Why are Christians being massacred in this fashion by these jihadists?
Yes, well, if you read the Washington Post, the headline on the attack was "Obscure Sri Lanka Group Eyed in Blasts." So you see the elimination of all context. The best way to put the context back in, which is what we've been living in nearly 18 years since 9/11, is a cycle of resurgent Islamic jihad. This is something we can go back and look at through the centuries across the continents, where you see these efforts by jihadists to capture, dominate, force into submission all manner of native peoples and nationalities and religions that are not Islamic. And this is essentially another horrific, violent outburst of jihad, this time in Sri Lanka. We still don't know the genesis of what happened in Notre Dame. We may never know, but we watched the beginning of Holy Week with Notre Dame in France, Paris, France burn, and then we end on Easter Sunday with this grievous attack on Christians and others, tourists included, Westerners in Sri Lanka. So we have to fit it into the larger context of this global jihad against the un-Islamic world, which is currently in a very advanced state of Islamization through the acceptance of Sharia blasphemy laws and all the rest of it. I mean, the compliance with Sharia is the ultimate goal.
Right, yes. Submission. This brings us to a film that you have recently seen, Diana. I have not had the privilege of doing so, produced by Tommy Robinson, a very courageous, somewhat controversial, to be sure, but very feisty freedom fighter against the forces of Sharia supremacism. Tell us about the film and what is its maiden message.
Well, he's an extraordinary man, Tommy Robinson, and he is a hero. He's a great, epic hero of our times, as a result of which he has been shut down. He's been turned into a non-person by the giants of social media in terms of his Instagram account, his Facebook page, his Twitter. He can't use PayPal. All of the measures we're seeing weaponized against conservatives generally are certainly deployed to destroy him. And in ways that go, you know, even beyond what we've seen in some of the more familiar cases in America, Tommy Robinson being British. What he's done in this new documentary that he's made, which I recommend to people, it's called Panodrama. And it is essentially, in some ways, the dream of anyone who's been maligned in any form by mainstream media, by the establishment, because he essentially turns the tables on an attempt by the BBC to take him down. Literally, the name of the BBC project internally was Tommy Takedown. And what he is able to do by having various sources of the BBC documentary against, who are supposed to be against him, are actually helping him expose the production as a scripted fake news effort to destroy his credibility, whatever's left of it in the public mind after what they've been doing for all these years, at least a decade. And it's quite fascinating because he is able to have a confrontation with the lead interviewer, a man by the name of John Sweeney, who has been filmed by Tommy's people undercover, arranging the interviews, using terrible language, projecting the idea of creating sort of a Me Too sexual plot against Tommy to smear him, even though it's certainly not true in as we learn, as we watch this. I mean, just the most nefarious measures. But what is also exposed is the role that a group very much like the American Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC, there is a group in Britain called Hope Not Hate, a George Soros-funded group that targets conservatives, just as SPLC does here. In fact, quite a number of us are also targeted by this British group, or at least listed by them, or on their radar, you and I, of course. And Hope Not Hate, Tommy is able to expose, and it's on film, you can watch for yourself. Hope Not Hate, according to witnesses, was present in certain preparatory interviews that the BBC, ostensibly an independent organization, was conducting in this effort to take down Tommy Robinson. So Hope Not Hate seems to be very influential at the BBC in terms of its content. And Tommy Robinson is able to expose this and really show the skeleton here of fake news, show it how it's made, or maybe sausage making is a better simile, just to understand the lies and corruption and staging that goes on in the creation of a takedown.
Well, and this isn't the only takedown, of course, that Tommy has been subjected to. As you know, Dinah West, and I think our audience does as well, this is a man who was thrown into jail, including with some Muslims who would most likely want to tear him to pieces on the most bizarre pretext that, you know, was another example in that case of Her Majesty's government trying to take him down. And the fact that he survived the experience is a credit to him, of course, and God's grace, I suppose. But it's a very important message to all of us, a message that has been designed, of course, to silence us. But in the person of people like you, Dinah West, fortunately, people are fighting back, are refusing to conform to Sharia blasphemy, or for that matter, any other of the diktats of Sharia supremacism. And I hope that by your example and your visits with us each week, we will inspire a great many others to do the same. Dinah, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again tomorrow. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, better known now for his role as the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at Blaze TV. You can find out how to take that aboard, the incredibly important information he's generating and his briefings on how you can help at economicwarroom.com. Kevin Freeman is also a profoundly influential blogger at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and he has a new piece up there, as a matter of fact, describing the Mueller report as a classic distraction from a corrupt media and a compromised intelligence community. And this is a very good follow-on to the conversation I had a moment ago with Dinah West. Kevin Freeman, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Great. Thank you, Frank.
So what's this about, this deflection or distraction, as you put it? It seems to me that's pretty clearly what's going on here. But I think putting the spotlight on not just Mueller and the corruption that we've been hearing a lot about in the FBI and in the Justice Department, but also in the media and, of course, in the intelligence community as well, is important to fold into this larger picture. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, whether you call it the deep state or whatever you want to call it, the people that have been running our government back since the Clinton era in so many ways are pulling off a magician's trick. They're trying to get us to look at whether or not President Trump obstructed justice by, you know, threatening to fire Comey and all these things. And, oh, we can't rule on that. If you peel back, to go back to the original issue, you've got to start with the fact that Trump called for Russia to find those emails jokingly in a speech. Why? Because the emails were missing. Why? Because they've been bleached bit from a server that where internal emails acknowledged this was a cover-up. Why? Because Hillary Clinton had her server in a homebrew bathroom situation where you could literally hack in, and frankly, there were email copies being sent off to the Chinese. Why? Because she was extraordinarily compromised, and you go back and you dig back and you realize she was covering up because the Clinton Foundation was receiving all kinds of money from foreign governments on issues they were dealing with at the State Department when she was Secretary of State. So she had to have them excluded, and the FBI let her exclude them. They didn't even look at those emails, and they actually granted immunity to the people that they were talking to, so there was no General Flynn indictment for lying to the FBI. They were allowed to do it. And they destroyed the laptops afterwards. You go back, this is the original corruption, and all Trump did was point it out, and he's being charged with obstruction of justice and all of the other issues. So the crime, the real crime, happened with the Clintons, and it happened during the Obama administration, and right now the magician is trying to get us to look elsewhere.
Yeah. You know, I was listening to National Public Radio earlier today, and there was a long riff about the Trump Tower and how what Robert Mueller has reported about the preoccupation of President Trump as a businessman and his family with getting a luxury high-rise in Moscow was a source of compromise and possible manipulation. And I just wonder, Kevin, as you've been studying these things, there were two events that weren't just prospective deals, but actual consummated ones between Hillary Clinton and the Russians, using, of course, the cutout of the Clinton Foundation. But this Uranium One transaction, in which 20% of America's uranium reserves were transferred to the Russians. And then this so-called Skolkovo initiative, where we were transferring enormous amounts of, in some cases, very sensitive dual-use technology, including hypersonic rocket technology that is now being used to threaten us, was transferred in exchange for hundreds of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation by some of the people who stood to benefit. This idea, I mean, you talk about distractions or deflections, that we're not actually focused on real criminal conduct, it would seem to me, if not downright treasonous conduct. Instead, we're following, you know, off on this tangent is a classic, as you say, magician's trick.
Absolutely. There's no question. I mean, the Skolkovo, it's $150 to $175 million, something like that. It's given to the Clinton Foundation so that we would transfer technology. But that's not the first time the Clintons did it. Our two main adversaries, Russia and China, the Clintons under President Clinton gave most favored nation status to the Chinese, which has allowed all of this bad trade and passing of secrets and everything else. And then with Russia, they've done both of them, sold out our country in exchange for money and power. There's no question about this.
Well, the Chinese, let's not forget, back during the Clinton presidency, got multiple independently targetable reentry vehicle technology, which means essentially the kind of thing that is now, again, threatening this country on Chinese intercontinental range and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. It's just staggering what the damage is that's been done. Hey, Kevin, let me move quickly to a couple of other things on China. The Chinese, we have been told in an article in the Washington Post over the weekend, ought to be given the opportunity to spy on us. I'd like to ask you about the advisability of that proposition and whether the Chinese need any encouragement to be doing it. What do we know about the level of espionage that they are conducting against us in the economic warfare space in particular, but more generally as well?
Well, let's start with the premise. The premise of the Washington Post article was that if we let them spy on us, I think it's David Fickling that wrote this, if we let them spy on us, we're less likely to get into a war. If we surrender completely, we are less likely to get into a war also. It's just insane, the thought and the reasoning. And the Chinese have sent human intelligence. They have spies that actively work here, that work for the People's Liberation Army, or they work for the Chinese government in one way or another. But they also have every company that comes here, and the companies are told by under law, you have to work for the government if we demand it. And the same thing for all of the 300,000 plus Chinese students that they send here. If we ask you to, you will spy for us. That's a requirement before you get permission to come to the United States to attend a university. So they are very active in their spy campaign, and I do not believe that it is good for us, or it prevents us or keeps us out of war. I think a strong America is what keeps us out of war, and I think the idea that we have to hand over secrets so that we don't get into war is insane.
And, you know, the implication of this piece, as I read it, was that this would not be a fully reciprocated kind of opportunity to spy on them. They're not going to have any part of that, of course, and do everything they can, including rolling up our espionage networks where they can find them. Kevin, in this regard, I did want to just call attention to this story that broke about a Chinese employee of a carrier operating out of JFK being arrested in connection with the illegal shipment of packages for the benefit of the People's Liberation Army in China. I guess this is what you're talking about in terms of people doing the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party or its subsidiaries, no?
It is the law. There is no choice. If you are a company that operates in China, you have to do the bidding. And therefore, ultimately, you do your commerce. But ultimately, if you're asked, you will go, and this indictment talks about the rewards that come with that. You get special rewards. You get opportunities to live in New York. You get construction workers to build and do construction on your apartment. You get all kinds of benefits associated with it. But make no mistake, that it is not a choice. If you work for a PRC company, People's Republic of China company, or a PLA company, you are required to serve the master. And so we have to look with concern at every time a Chinese company that's operating in the United States might be compromised by their government. We should assume that it's possible and probably likely.
Yeah, likely is the operative word, of course. Hey, Kevin, let me turn to one other item. The U.S., we're told by the Wall Street Journal, has surrendered to the People's Republic of China in connection with our respective work on scientific research. This is an issue that has come up again and again in my conversations with David Goldman. What's your take on that assessment, and what are its implications?
Well, we used to be the leader in scientific research, and China used to steal our secrets, and that was bad enough. But what's happened is while we've pulled back in scientific research in so many ways, the Chinese have expanded. And so they're now actually taking leadership roles in artificial intelligence and 5G and other critical technologies to the future, but also technologies that can be used to literally rule the world. And so we've pulled back. The Chinese have advanced. It is no longer that they are just stealing ideas because they can't create and invent. Their patents are off the charts compared to ours. Their STEM-focused science, technology, engineering, and math-focused students are off the charts compared to ours. They are now leading. So they are almost at a point they don't have to steal technology or leadership from us, that they are inventing it on our own, and we're going to be left in the dust. So this is another whole aspect of the economic war we're facing.
Yeah. So this somewhat chauvinistic notion that the Chinese just didn't have it in them to actually innovate and create, they could only copy, is now being shown to be untrue, especially when they've obtained the benefits of the best educations the American academic institutions are capable of providing for a generation or two.
So we have, on the one hand, Harvard possibly discriminating against Asian students because they're getting too good of scores and they're overrepresented. And then the other hand, we say, oh, the Chinese, they're not smart. They just copy and they have to steal our stuff. That's crazy. They are very bright people. They have a terrible system, and it is a system that is a threat to the world. But the people themselves are extraordinary, and they're taking advantage of it. And the idea of, you know, all right, we should hand them our secrets, and now they're innovating beyond us. This just shows the insanity of the American approach.
Yeah. Kevin Freeman, thanks for all you do at Blaze TV, as well as globaleconomicwarfare.com. Come back to us again next week.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Fred Fleitz, a man who we are privileged to have not only visit us weekly here at Secure Freedom Radio, but also lead the organization that sponsors this program, the Center for Security Policy, where he is its president and CEO. He is an old friend of mine and a much admired intelligence professional, one who has spent almost two decades as an analyst in the Central Intelligence Agency, worked on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence as a professional staff member, and served under Ambassador John Bolton, first when he was in the State Department as an Undersecretary of State, and then at the National Security Council as his Chief of Staff. Fred Fleitz, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
So, a couple of things that are sort of top of mind are things that have been in your wheelhouse for a long time. Let's start with the announcement this week by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that the United States was going to end the practice of waiving the importation by five countries, China, India, Turkey, Japan, and South Korea, of oil from the government of Iran. Obviously, it's a great benefit to that government, and the Trump administration is doing what it can to apply maximum pressure. I was delighted to see the waivers ended. What did you make of it, and what's likely to come of it?
I was very happy to hear this decision, Frank. There was a lot going on behind the scenes. I will tell you that there were people in the bowels of the State Department that didn't just want to continue these exemptions. They wanted to expand them. And frankly, I wasn't sure that the senior officials who were supporting the president would win this battle. I don't think we should have had exemptions in the first place. And I'll tell you that these people were fighting very hard against what the president wanted. The president wants maximum pressure against Iran. That's what Ambassador Bolton wants. That's what Secretary Pompeo wants. And I was pleased to see that the decision came out right. And look, let's be frank here. The nuclear deal with Iran extends the rule of the mullahs. It gives them money they can use to oppress their people and sponsor terrorism and meddle in regional conflicts. When we sanction this government, we're denying them this money that they use to oppress their people and engage in belligerent and terroristic activities. It was the right thing to do. It is another big win for President Trump.
The degree to which it will constitute a win, of course, will in part depend on what happens next. And Fred, as you know very well, some of these countries are not terribly good friends of the United States, China notably among them. A couple of them are, you know, sort of non-aligned types or former allies even. Turkey comes to mind in that category, India. And then there's, of course, Japan and South Korea, which are allies of ours. This will, despite the fact that there were 6 months of sort of this waiver in place, probably cause some hardship for some of these countries. And there's rumor that some will simply defy the sanctions of the United States. So what would you expect will come next and the implications of it?
Well, Saudi Arabia supports these sanctions. So, and we also know that there's more than enough oil in the open market right now to accommodate what Iran is producing. And of course, there's going to be cheating. But we heard a similar argument when the president reimposed sanctions when he got out of the Iran deal, and European countries said, well, that doesn't matter. We're going to stay in the deal. Most of the major companies in European countries abided by our sanctions because between choosing between doing business with the United States and Iran, it's not a difficult decision. Iran's a terrible place to do business. Sometimes your businessmen get arrested when they're there. Iran doesn't pay its bills. I think at the end of the day, most of the states who are subject to these oil sanctions are going to abide by them.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Fred, another country that doesn't get oil from Iran, as far as we know, but certainly has been getting oil from places like Russia and I guess China surreptitiously, is North Korea. The president has a maximum pressure campaign going with them, too. The government of North Korea, in the person of Kim Jong-un, has met with the president twice now, and there's talk about a third summit. There's also clearly a degree of restiveness, shall we say, on the part of the North Koreans, specifically with respect to continuing to exercise restraint in their weapons program. There was a test of a tactical system last week, we're told. There's also the cheating that's going on to get some of that oil and other sanctioned items into North Korea. There's also, in addition, Fred, an increasing degree of rhetorical, well, shall we say, vitriol aimed at a number of the people around President Trump, your old boss, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, among them. So far, the president hasn't gotten whacked by his friend, Kim Jong-un, but this does seem to be evidence that the hoped-for rapprochement is not materializing. Is that how you see it?
Well, let me first stipulate, I've had the privilege of discussing North Korea with the president, not real recently, but within the last couple of months. And he thinks that he's achieved a lot in stopping the missile tests and the nuclear tests, and he's improved the relationship with North Korea. He thinks that this personal relationship with Kim Jong-un is going to yield major benefits. When we see the North Korean government ridiculing Ambassador Bolton and Secretary Pompeo, I think they said that Ambassador Bolton lacks charm. I'm not sure what that means.
There are a lot of people who would agree with that. I'm not among them, but there are some.
Well, you know, they're tough guys. They're pushing for a tough policy, and the North Koreans don't like it. If John Kerry was our negotiator, they wouldn't be saying that. I mean, these are pushing for a good deal. That's what President Trump has said. I might say he's also said with China, he doesn't want a good deal. He wants a great deal. And I think that's the same thing with North Korea. And the North Koreans are irritated that they can't roll us, that Bolton and Pompeo are standing up to them.
And we're not easing the sanctions in the meantime in exchange for essentially nothing. Do you see any likelihood that Kim will have his way in insisting that Mike Pompeo be dropped from the role of interlocutor with the North Koreans?
No, this isn't the first time the North Koreans have criticized Pompeo. It's what they do. They make bombastic threats. They talk a good game. I think that the president has caught their attention. I'm hoping they see that there's an opportunity here where both sides can do pretty well. I think the North Koreans are doing better than they certainly deserve to do, given that it is such an oppressive state, guilty of probably the worst human rights violations on earth. But it's a state that we have to deal with in the region. We have to promote security in the region. So there's some difficult trade-offs here to come up with an agreement with the North Koreans. And it's simply something that a superpower with a pragmatic foreign policy has to work. And I think Pompeo and Bolton have a good plan to do this. As Bolton said, we've opened the door to peace to Kim, and he has to walk through that door.
Right. Well, again, we're watching breathlessly to see whether he will. Fred, let me turn to one other topic. Again, John Bolton was in the news last week. We spoke earlier in the program with Frank Calzone about the remarks that he made down in Miami concerning Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua, for that matter, in what he calls the troika of terror. What effectively John announced was a further ratcheting up of what one might call an increasingly maximum pressure campaign on the Cubans as well, specifically with respect to a provision of law that has been ignored by successive administrations to this point, that give those whose property was expropriated by the Castro regime some time ago legal recourse. Do you have any sense of whether this is likely to catalyze the sorts of change that we've been hoping for a long time on the island of Cuba?
Well, I hope so. Remember that the president has called President Obama's decision to normalize relations with Havana terrible and misguided. And this was done with no notice to Congress. It was another unilateral action that the Obama administration did because it thought it was smarter than everyone else in the United States. It was smarter than the U.S. Congress, and a majority of Congress objected to this. So surprise, surprise, this terrible policy is being reversed. I think it's about time we do this. And also it is in response to Cuba's support of the Maduro government in Venezuela. We are upping the pressure against Venezuela across the board. And frankly, if the Cuban government is going to continue to support Maduro, we are going to increase the pain to them for doing so. This is the first step.
Yeah, and a vitally needed one too, Fred, because as we've talked about in the past, the life support that Cuba, in the person of Praetorian guards among Maduro, among other things, and the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians are providing to that odious regime is something that really has to be countered. And this is an important step, as you say, in that direction. Thank you for talking with us about it, Fred Flights, as well as your leadership of the Center for Security Policy. We look forward to visiting with you again next week. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.